Well, good evening, everybody. It is August the 23rd, 2012, a Thursday evening here in North America, and tonight is the last of our six meetings in Austrian microeconomics. Tonight we're going to talk about competition and monopoly as an extension of the discussions we've previously had about pricing, about profit maximization, about entrepreneurship, and so on. It's a little bit bittersweet, of course, because tonight is our last meeting together, and I have certainly enjoyed sharing the last 8 weeks, I guess it's been, with you guys. And I hope that you've enjoyed the course and that you've gotten something out of it. So I'm sad that our course is ending, but I'm happy that that means I get paid. I'm happy that we had a good time together and that we can go on and continue to interact in the coming weeks. No, seriously, I hope that those of you who are taking your first Mises Academy course will be interested in taking some more and maybe coming to some of our conferences, the Mises University in the summer, or the more advanced Rothbard Graduate Seminar for those of you doing advanced research in economics or a related field. Any of our special topic conferences, be delighted to see you there, and I hope that you'll continue with your own personal study, reading materials that you can get from Mises.org and elsewhere. And those of you who are full-time students at the undergraduate or graduate level, I hope that you will continue your studies and that you will be very successful in whatever you do. And I certainly hope that all of you will feel completely free to contact me by email or whatever long after the course is over to continue the conversations that we've started and to help develop relationships and just to keep in touch. You know, there's a lot of material that we could cover in a course like that, and it's been really difficult. It's been a challenge for me to condense everything that I might want to talk about related to price theory or causal realist or Austrian microeconomics into six lectures. And, you know, there's a lot more that we could do on the production side. There's a lot more that we could do about entrepreneurs and firms. A lot that we could do about kind of legal and regulatory issues associated with prices and exchange and markets, obviously as the foundational set of concepts and constructs for all of economic analysis. You know, you could spend years just thinking about Austrian microeconomics, but we only have six lectures. And what I decided to do for the last of our six lectures was focus on competition and monopoly, partly because there is a lot of contrast between the Austrian or causal realist approach to competition and monopoly and the mainstream approach in economics and in law. You know, comparing Austrian and mainstream views of different economics concepts to some of you may seem a little bit pedantic or may seem like hair splitting or something that's not particularly important. You know, those of you who are economic students at a mainstream college or university and being constantly exposed to the neoclassical approach particularly enjoy seeing these comparisons, and I've talked to a lot of you privately between sessions about, you know, how do I critique what my professor is saying about this or that aspect of neoclassical theory. Others of you, those of you who are working professionals, for example, or specialists in another field and just interested in learning, you know, good economics, may not be as interested in comparison and contrast with, you know, bad economics. Competition and monopoly is one area where everybody has to care because the dominant legal framework in all developed countries, as the law, as regulators, and so on, approach what they call competition policy, is almost all exclusively based on bad economics, right? So the dominant approaches to antitrust and business regulation are almost all based on what I would call a faulty understanding of competition and monopoly. That's why it's critically important that we understand the differences between Austrian or causal realist approaches to these problems and mainstream neoclassical approaches. let's start with the concept of competition itself. What do we mean by competition? You know, in everyday language, competition typically refers to some kind of a contest, some kind of rivalry, right? The Olympics just concluded a few weeks ago, and you know, you might talk to your friends about how much you enjoyed the competition, or boy, I'm really looking forward to the competition in football or basketball or whatever sport is coming up. We think of competition as, you know, a sort of striving among rivals, one participant trying to do better than his rivals, to beat the other guy, or one team trying to beat the other team. As this applies to business, commerce, exchange, right? We might think of, Apple being in competition with Microsoft, or a hardware company, or Apple being in competition with the recording industry, or something like that. Starbucks is competing with other coffee makers. Airbus and Boeing engage in intense competition, to land the next contract for with an airline or what have you. That's the normal, common sense, everyday notion of competition as rivalry. Now, in an economic sense, it might the way we might apply that common sense notion to thinking about business behavior is, or market behavior, to think of competition as, the absence of legal restrictions to a particular behavior. In other words, competition as freedom, right? So we might say, look, Starbucks, even though it's a very large company that sells a lot of coffee, in antitrust jargon, you might say Starbucks has a large market share in many cities and towns. But Starbucks has to compete with other sellers, right? It competes with other coffee shops. It competes with proprietors of other kinds of beverages. Starbucks sells pastries and donuts, and it competes in that sense with the local bakery or the Walmart donut store or Krispy Kreme or Dunkin' Donuts or whatever. Starbucks, one of the products that Starbucks also sells is, the environment, a place to hang out, a place to do work on your laptop, with the free Wi-Fi, or a place to sit down and chat with your friends. And of course, Starbucks there is competing with people's offices, with McDonald's that offers free Wi-Fi in most of its locations, with somebody's home as a place to get together and chat. Right, so competition for Starbucks means Starbucks has no government protection against people wanting to offer the same thing that Starbucks offers. Right, Starbucks has no legal monopoly on customers. It has to compete for its customers. And anybody has the freedom to try to get some of those customers from Starbucks, to lure the customers to its own business, right? So competition in this sense, in the sense of absence of legal restrictions, means that any individual or any firm can try to compete in any particular market. In other words, a market is competitive in this sense if anyone is free to give it a shot, if anyone is free to enter that market and to try to persuade people to trade with you in the market. Okay? Now, of course, one implication that is obvious from sporting competition, right, is that the ability to give it a shot is no guarantee of success. Right? It isn't the case that everyone can effectively compete. Right, I can set up Klein's coffee bar, but it's unlikely that a lot of people would prefer my coffee bar to Starbucks, at least not in the beginning, not unless I'm particularly good, not unless I offer something that nobody else can offer. Right? So in other words, we would all expect, right, that in the 100-meter dash, Usain Bolt is going to be faster than Peter Klein. And I would be much faster than Bob Murphy or Tom Woods or any of these losers, right? In other words, the results of competition are typically unequal. Okay, we would not expect that every coffee store has an equal share of the market. We wouldn't expect that every retailer, every manufacturer, every airplane maker or whatever would be just as good as every other one, or would have a total, you know, totally equal, egalitarian distribution. It's not like little children in kindergarten, right, where you don't rank them and every little child in kindergarten is wonderful and they all get a prize for being the best student and so on. Real world competition is not like that. There are winners and losers, right, in the sense of finishing in second place or not doing as well as somebody else. That's common sense to everybody except mainstream neoclassical economists, who, as we'll see in more detail a few slides later, think that competition means not only everyone can be in the market, but everyone is in the market. Right? A market is only competitive if every single person who could conceivably be in that market is actually in it and doing just as well as everybody else. No firm, no seller can be more successful than another seller. No buyer can be more effective than another buyer if the market is quote-unquote competitive, according to mainstream neoclassical economists. And you can see how that will get us into all kinds of trouble. Okay. Now, what about the word monopoly? Right, so historically, the word monopoly, as it came out of the English common law framework, and as it was understood by most people until the 19th and 20th centuries, monopoly meant the absence of freedom, a restriction on freedom. In other words, a company would have a monopoly on some market if the government made it the exclusive provider in that market, right? You know, the Dutch East India Company in the 17th, 18th centuries had a legal monopoly on trade between Europe and Indonesia, right? The Dutch crown simply granted a special privilege and said, only this company may engage in this kind of trade. If anybody else does it, you can shoot them. Right? The Navy will shoot them. You will go to jail. It's illegal to compete in that particular market. Or in most countries today, you know, the Postal Service. The United States has the U.S. Postal Service, and it is illegal to offer the same product that the Postal Service offers, you know, depending on how you define it, of course. So there are overnight parcel delivery services like Federal Express. Of course, email competes with the post office, the fax machine competes with the post office, but the government in the U.S. has defined what they call first-class mail, you know, the delivery of individual letters to someone's home, and it is illegal for anyone but the Postal Service to do that. The official government-approved mailboxes that every home in the United States is required to have can only be used by U.S. government postal workers. And those of you who live in the U.S. know, you know, every year there's, you hear, read in the news about, some little Girl Scout troop that was selling cookies, or they had little flyers they wanted to put in people's mailboxes saying, please buy our cookies, and they put these flyers, little handwritten notes, in the U.S. government-approved mailbox, and, you know, these little girls got arrested, right, or their parents got arrested. That is illegal. You cannot use the mailbox because you are not an officially licensed government worker. You can think of all kinds of other services, all kinds of other products in which the government has a legal monopoly, or some private firm has been given a legal monopoly on that particular market. That's what everybody understood monopoly to mean before the 20th century. And then some economists came along and said, no, monopoly doesn't have anything to do with government privilege. Monopoly is when you are big and successful, right? If competition means a market in which nobody is any better than anybody else, then monopoly must mean a market where somebody is better than anybody else, where some firm has a big share of the market, where some firm earns a lot of profit. That's the definition of monopoly in mainstream economics. Now, how they get that right is with these certain imaginary constructions, the imaginary constructions of so-called perfect competition and imperfect competition. I'll have more to say about those in a moment. But perfect competition is the state where, again, there are no winners, no losers, everybody wins the race, every firm is identical to every other firm, and there are a bazillion of them, and none of them can effectively influence the others, and so on. That imaginary construction is defined by the neoclassicals as a competitive market. Anything that is not that must be an imperfectly competitive or monopolized market, i.e., by definition, they've made all real-world markets to be monopolies of one sort or another. And part of the reason they do that is to give a rationale for a government to step in and intervene in some way to undo the monopoly or to protect consumers against the monopolist. Forget about that for a moment. Let's first talk about a correct theory of monopoly, a simple theory of quote-unquote monopoly pricing that comes from the Austrian school, that comes from Karl Menger and his followers. Right? Menger did have a theory of monopoly. Menger did think there was such a thing as monopoly, but he said monopoly and its counterpart, monopsony. So monopoly refers to a condition on the supply side of the market, right? In certain market configurations, sellers can exercise monopoly privilege. If you're talking about buyers having the monopoly of buyers, that's called monopsony. Okay, so monopoly and monopsony, according to Menger, those are legitimate concepts, but they're defined in terms of the characteristics of the buyers and sellers in the market, which are, you know, held to be determined exogenously. In other words, the preferences of these buyers and sellers, their willingness to buy, their willingness to sell, their configuration, whether they're in the market, out of the market, and so on, that these things have an effect on the equilibrium price. Characteristics of buyers and sellers in the market have an effect on the equilibrium price. It turns out that this quite reasonable theory of monopoly was very popular until about the 1930s, when a new theory of monopoly, what was called imperfect competition, associated with the economist E.A.G. Chamberlain and in particular Joan Robinson, these theories sort of swept the field of economics, and the Mengerian approach was swept aside and forgotten. The Mengerian approach was revitalized by Mises and Rothbard, in particular by Rothbard, who emphasized the role of legal restrictions, going back to the common sense, common law notion of monopoly. We'll say a little more about Rothbard later. But let me explain what Menger meant with a few simple examples. So, remember the examples that we went through in, I think it was week two of the course, where we're explaining prices in terms of buyer behavior and seller behavior and so on. So imagine a market, right? Remember we were talking about my car radios? So this could be like the car radio market. Imagine a market in which there is only one seller. Okay, so there's a single seller of the commodity in question, a quote-unquote monopoly seller, right? So imagine there's one seller and there's only one unit of the good or service in question, you know, one radio. There's one seller with one radio and there's multiple buyers, five buyers, each of whom wants a radio, right? We studied this exact example several weeks ago. In fact, I just copied and pasted the numbers here, right? So the equilibrium outcome is that the good goes to the most capable buyer at a price something between his reservation price and the reservation price of the next most capable buyer, assuming that both of those are above the seller's reservation price. In other words, if the seller's reservation price was $450, then the equilibrium would be there is no trade, Q star equal to zero. Right, but as long as at least one buyer has a reservation price above the seller's reservation price, and in this case, if there are at least two buyers whose willingness to pay is greater than the seller's minimum willingness to sell, right, then the good is going to go to the most capable buyer, that's B1, and the price will be somewhere between B1's reservation price, $300, and B2's reservation price, $275. depending on the negotiating skill, negotiating practices and skills between these two potential buyers and the seller. Okay, we looked at this exact same example before. Slightly different case, right? Suppose the seller has multiple units of the good. Imagine this seller has, for example, three units of the good, at least three units of the good, minimum willingness to sell for $150. And let's say that there are three buyers, each of whom is willing to pay, there are three units of the good and at least three buyers who are willing to pay more than $150. What's going to happen? Then, you know, three units will be sold. All three units of the good will go from the seller to a buyer. The three most capable buyers will be the ones who get it, right? And the equilibrium price will be somewhere between the reservation price of the least capable buyer who does in fact buy, that's B3, and the most capable buyer who does not buy, who is excluded from the market, that's B4, right? So equilibrium price of three if there are three units of the good available at a price somewhere between $250 and $225. What if we have lots of sellers? Okay, so imagine now we have five potential sellers, not just one. Okay, and these five sellers, assume they all have the same reservation price. So there's five sellers, each of whom would be willing to get rid of their radio for $150, right? If all five buyers have reservation prices above $150, then equilibrium quantity is five. All five radios will be sold, right? And the equilibrium price will be somewhere between the reservation price of the least capable buyer who does in fact buy, in this case B5. I'm sorry, I haven't been using my pointer. Reservation price will be somewhere between the equilibrium price, I'm sorry, will be somewhere between the reservation price of the least capable buyer who buys, that's B5, and this $150 reservation price that all the sellers share. Right, so equilibrium price somewhere between $150 and $200. So do you see what's going on here? When we had only one unit of the good, right, available for sale, one seller and one unit of the good, even though his reservation price was $150, the equilibrium price was high, right? It was somewhere between $300 and $275 when there was only one unit of the good. Now we have five sellers and five units of the good, and the equilibrium price is much lower, right? Because you have multiple sellers competing against each other, right? The seller with the reservation price of $150, he can't say, hey, wait a minute, you know, I'm going to try to get the price to be somewhere between $300 and $275. No, he can't do that because there are other sellers who say, well, hey, I'll sell it to you for $274. And somebody else says, I'll sell it to you for $273, and so on. Right, and because we have multiple sellers, each of whom is willing to sell at $150, we don't get an equilibrium price that's that much above $150, right? It's somewhere between $150 and the willingness to pay of the least most capable buyer, $200. So notice our equilibrium price is lower in this example than it was in the previous two examples. And you can imagine a case where you have multiple sellers with the same reservation price, but it's higher. Right, so same setup as the last slide, but assume the reservation prices are, you know, instead of $150, now they're $240. Okay, so there's five sellers, each of whom has a radio they'd be willing to sell. But if all of them, you know, have a pretty high valuation, $240, then you know, B4 is not going to get one. Right, B1, B2, and B3 will all be willing to bid high enough to get a radio. B4 and B5 are going to go away without a radio because they aren't willing to pay the minimum price that any seller requires. Okay, so same setup as before, but just by changing the reservation prices from $150 to $240, we get a new equilibrium where only three radios will be sold, right? And the equilibrium price will be somewhere between the willingness to pay of the least most capable buyer who buys B3, and the reservation price of, you know, the first excluded seller, which could be any of them, $240. So much higher equilibrium price here than we did in the previous example, not by changing the number of buyers or the number of sellers or the number of radios that could possibly be sold, but simply by changing the reservation prices of the sellers. Right? And notice, by the way, there's nothing at all illegitimate about sellers changing their reservation prices. Right? I mean, why should the sellers have a reservation price of $150? That's nobody's business but their own. Maybe everybody who has a radio really likes the radio and wouldn't be willing to give it up for less than $240. Or if these are just pure commercial sellers, right? Maybe they believe or suspect that tomorrow or next week the price will, they'll be able to sell them for $240. They believe that the future equilibrium price is $240, and therefore they're not willing to unload their radios for anything less than $240. Whether it's a change in their personal preferences, change in their expectations, whatever. If they go from $150 to $240 as their reservation prices, that's going to have an effect on equilibrium price. Totally legitimate, totally natural, understandable, explainable, just a different outcome. What if we have multiple units of the good, multiple buyers, each of whom have different reservation prices? Well, some of you may notice this is the same slide from one of the ones that we did several weeks ago when we were doing the marginal pairs, right? In fact, these are the same numbers. This is a case where you have multiple buyers, multiple sellers, some of whom have reservation prices that mesh and some of whom don't, right? This is the same example we did before where the equilibrium quantity is 4, right? There are 4 buyers who end up with a radio. One of the sellers holds on to his radio, the one who values it the most, the one who values it at $230, and the equilibrium price is going to be somewhere between $210, right? That's the reservation price of the most capable seller who doesn't sell, and $225, the reservation price of the the least capable buyer who does buy. Okay, and if you've forgotten about this, go back and read the wonderful article by Danny Sanchez on Mises.org, or go back and listen to, I think it was my lecture two. What is my point in doing all this? What's my point in going through these examples? The equilibrium prices and quantities depend not on the number of buyers and sellers per se, but on the reservation prices of the buyers and sellers in the market. Right? So it's not how many sellers are in the market or how many buyers are in the market necessarily, though that can have some influence. Right? It's what are the reservation prices of the buyers and sellers in the market. Right? If all sellers have the same reservation price, and that is below at least the reservation price of at least some buyers, then equilibrium prices are decreasing in the number of sellers other things equal. Let me say that again. If all sellers have a uniform reservation price, and there are at least some buyers who are willing to pay above that reservation price, then the more sellers in the market, the lower that equilibrium price, ceteris paribus. Remember, when there was only one seller in the market, that seller could bargain for a price between the reservation price of the most capable buyer who buys and the reservation price of the next most capable buyer who doesn't buy because there are no more goods available for sale. Right? When you had multiple sellers competing against each other, then they could no longer bargain in that same way because the sellers are jockeying for position against other sellers. And any seller who is being able to try to negotiate a price that's way above the common reservation price, another seller will simply come in and say, no, I'll offer it to the buyer for even less than that. Okay? Or to flip it around another way, right? If all buyers, to look at it from the buy side, if you have multiple buyers who have the same reservation price, and there's at least one seller who's willing to sell to those buyers, then the equilibrium prices are increasing in the number of buyers, other things equal. The more buyers competing against each other, the more the price will be bargained up until it's just below the reservation price of the least capable buyer who buys, and so on. Right? Now, of course, there's no reason to believe that these are sort of the normal cases, the usual cases. You might have markets that you know, you might have markets that are like these examples. You may have other configurations of buyer and seller preferences. But notice that, you know, all we're doing here is making some positive statements about what the equilibrium price likely will be under different configurations of buyer and seller preferences. Notice that there isn't any normative implication. We can say absolutely nothing about which of, I think I gave four examples, right? I mean, which of those four examples is best? Which of those four market outcomes, the four equilibrium prices and quantities, which one is, you know, social welfare maximizing? You know, absent legal restrictions, that question doesn't even make sense. I mean, in all four of the examples, we had voluntary interactions between buyers and sellers. We didn't have any coercion. We had, you know, each trade was welfare enhancing ex ante, in the sense that each buyer or seller who participated in that market exchanged or did not exchange because they expected to be better off, as opposed to the other, you know, better off than they would be if they engaged in some other course of action. Every transaction that took place was mutually beneficial, ex ante. We're all good. It's all good, right? We have no scientific basis for comparison across those four markets in terms of well-being or efficiency or market performance or something like that. Now, of course, if there's only one seller in the market because the government has said, if anybody else enters the market, they'll be shot. Okay, that's a different case. Then we would say, well, gosh, the price is different than it would be, you know, the price is higher than it would be, for example, if we had other sellers. And that suggests that the government's law has made the market outcome be different from what it would have been in the absence of coercion. So we can say that coercion of that form, you know, gives us a different equilibrium than we would have had if people were free to interact in ways that they expected to make themselves better off. And in that sense, we could say, well, this legal restriction seems like it could be harmful, right? It's potentially cutting off some trades that would have taken place. It's distorting the market price from the price that would have obtained if the government hadn't stepped in. But, you know, aside from government intervention, all these prices are good, are fine. Now, this is completely different from the neoclassical or mainstream approach that dominates business regulation, competition policy, antitrust law, and so on. Everything's still okay with video and audio for most of you? Somebody's saying they're having a problem. Video's okay? Okay. Sorry, I hope that was just one glitch for one person. Okay, so what do neoclassical economists mean by perfect competition, imperfect competition? Well, first of all, note that these are imaginary constructions, imaginary constructs, but they aren't useful ones. Okay, we talked earlier in the course about, you know, the imaginary construction of the evenly rotating economy, Mises' notion of the evenly rotating economy, which we discussed last week. We said this is a very useful construct for understanding the difference between, do you remember, between interest income and entrepreneurial profit, right? And we can only see that interest is a reward, is determined by time preference, and profit is determined by uncertainty bearing. We can only see that by imagining a world in which there is no uncertainty, hence there's no profit loss, but there is still business income due to time preference. You remember that from last week. Mises wasn't claiming that any economy is the ERE, right? Mises isn't saying that ERE exists, the ERE is realistic, or even 100% logically consistent. He's just saying, oh, imagine a case like this, and that will help us to see or isolate some features of real economy. But, of course, I didn't, in using that example and also that of Crusoe economics and a few others, I certainly didn't mean that all imaginary constructions are useful. In fact, I think the imaginary constructions of perfect and imperfect competition are particularly unhelpful and not useful and indeed downright harmful. This way of thinking, the mainstream neoclassical way of thinking, you know, is that, well, you can look at any market and you can assign it a different score or a rating on these various attributes. So what about the product? Is every seller selling exactly the same identical product, or is everybody's product a little bit different? You know, is a McDonald's hamburger the same as a Burger King hamburger, or are they perfect substitutes, or are they slightly different? You know, how many buyers are in the market? How many sellers are in the market? How big are they? Are they all the same size, or are some of them bigger than others? What are the restrictions on entry and exit? And here, when they talk about, you know, the ability to enter the market or leave the market, they don't mean just in the legal sense of, you know, again, nobody could compete with the Dutch East India Company without being shot. They don't mean that. They mean, well, you know, what if it's hard to enter a market just because the firms that are already in the market are so darn good, right? You know, there's no law that says I, Peter Klein, cannot write, write a computer program that controls the desktop of a PC, right? There's no law that says I can't create Klein Windows instead of Microsoft Windows, or, you know, whatever the Mac OS flavor of the current flavor is, Leopard or Tiger or Sea Lion or whatever it is. But it would just be really hard for me to do that, right? I mean, it's very unlikely that I would have the knowledge and expertise and the resources to create something like that. Now, Kleinex, I like that. I can create Kleinex, but probably nobody would really like it. According to mainstream neoclassical economics, that is an entry barrier that, you know, makes the market for computer operating systems inefficient. The fact that I simply can't enter the market because I'm not good enough, I don't have an accumulated the capital, I don't have the expertise, I don't have enough knowledge, whatever. According to this approach, the neoclassical approach, that's just the same thing as a law that says I couldn't enter the market. There are other assumptions about, you know, what kind of information people have. Do all firms have exactly the same knowledge and expertise about how to produce, or do some of them have better knowledge than others? That would also be an entry barrier. You know, and by characterizing markets with these criteria, you can then describe each market as being one of several kind of ideal types: perfect competition, monopolistic competition, oligopoly, pure monopoly. Okay. For example, what they call perfect competition is a market in which you have a homogeneous product, a huge number of buyers and sellers. I mean, technically, if you do the math, an infinite number of buyers and sellers, each of whom is infinitely small. Yeah, I know. I know. Perfectly free entry and exit, and perfect information. If those conditions obtain, then the market is perfectly competitive. By the way, what market do you know in the real world that's perfectly competitive? Obvious answer is none. Okay, none. That's what makes it an imaginary construct. If you have, say, you know, three or four firms in the market selling a homogeneous product with restrictions on entry and some restrictions on information, then that they would call that an oligopoly. A monopoly exists where there is one and only one seller in the market for whatever reason, whether it's legal or technological or whatever. You know, there's only one firm in the market, and only that firm sells that particular product. Nobody can enter the market without the permission of the incumbent. Usually people say, well, no market is perfectly competitive, but, you know, markets for commodities like wheat or milk or, ballpoint pens or something, those are kind of closer to perfect competition, because, you know, one farmer's wheat is not really different from another farmer's wheat, you can put them all together in a big pile of wheat, and they're all sort of dumping their product into the common market, and the farmers are pretty small relative to the total amount of wheat available, and so it seems like the wheat market is kind of close. I mean, actually, that's not even true. If you know anything about wheat, there are lots of different types of wheat, there are different grades of wheat, and of course nowadays there's organic wheat, you know, regular wheat, there's genetically modified wheat, non-GMO wheat, and so on. So even wheat is a market in which the product really is differentiated. But, you know, markets for automobiles, so that's an oligopoly because you just have a handful of companies, big companies competing against each other. In fact, in most mature markets, according to this theory, this way of thinking, you have most markets are dominated by a few large firms, and they either become or are already oligopolies, oligopolistic markets. The model of perfect competition gets a lot of attention in economics, mainstream economics textbooks. What is the, you know, what does a perfectly competitive firm do in this imaginary construct? Well, assuming it has an upward sloping marginal cost curve, meaning the unit cost of producing wheat or water or airplanes or whatever it is increasing as you produce more of them. There's an upward sloping marginal cost curve. And this weird demand curve, perfectly elastic demand curve. The idea is that each firm in the perfectly competitive market is so small relative to the whole market that the market price is just sort of, it's determined in the aggregate somehow, but each firm is so small it just takes the market price as given. So the firm, the perfectly competitive firm, acts as if it can sell as little or as much as it wants at the market price without affecting that price. In other words, the demand curve for Farmer Jones's wheat is horizontal. So the idea is that there's a demand curve for wheat in general, which is downward sloping, but the demand for any individual producer's wheat is horizontal because that producer's wheat is identical to every other producer's wheat. So, this one farmer, he can't sell more by, he can't earn more money by charging a premium for his wheat because nobody would buy from him. They would all buy from some other wheat farmer. And he can't make more money by cutting the price and trying to attract more customers because he's so small relative to the wheat market. He can already sell every bushel of wheat he brings to market at the going price without having to lower his price, so why would he? Right, so he sells every bushel of wheat at exactly the perfectly competitive market price, this P sub PC, price in perfect competition, which is determined exogenously to the firm. All of the stuff you get in intermediate texts about profit maximizing firm behavior is almost all based on this particular model. Right, so what quantity should the farmer produce? Well, the quantity where marginal revenue is equal to marginal cost, and because his demand curve is horizontal, he gets the same unit price for every unit he sells, then his marginal revenue is just equal to the market price. Every bushel of wheat he sells brings him $10 if that's the price of a bushel of wheat. So he just keeps producing until his marginal cost is equal to $10 at this equilibrium quantity QPC, and that maximizes his profit. So far so good, that says the neoclassical economist. But what if the market is not perfectly competitive? Right? What if the seller faces not a perfectly elastic horizontal demand curve, but a downward sloping demand curve for just his individual product? So now it's not the wheat farmer anymore. Now it's Microsoft selling copies of Microsoft Windows. Well, a simple bit of calculation will establish that if you have a demand curve that is downward sloping, in my example here, a linear straight line downward sloping demand curve. There's a marginal revenue curve that corresponds to that demand curve, which is also downward sloping, but it is steeper than and lies below the linear demand curve. And this is easy to see. I mean, this is true, but it's just true by simple numbers. In other words, imagine a demand curve. Let's see, can I draw? You're here. Whoa. Sorry. Let me undo that. And then let me make my pen smaller. Oh, if I make my pen smaller. Okay, that's better. Okay, so here's a demand schedule, just like the demand schedules we did a couple weeks ago. Right, so imagine that, you know, at a price of $10, the total quantity demanded by the market is one bushel. At a price of $9, two bushels, $8, three bushels, and so on. Right, so that gave me this demand curve right here. Okay, so this demand curve is just a plot of this demand schedule. It's the simplest one I can think of. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay. But you can calculate, right? You can calculate total revenue, the total amount of revenue received by the firm, by the seller, at every price, right? If the price is $10 a unit, you sell one unit and you earn $10. If the price is $9 a unit, you can sell two units, you earn $18. If the price is $8 a unit, you can sell three of them and you earn $24, and so on, right? So this is just multiplying. But what then is the change in revenue from producing one more unit? What's the marginal revenue? In other words, what is the increment to total revenue from producing one more unit? Well, when you go from one to two, right? When you produce one unit, you can sell it for 10. When you produce two units, you can sell them for only $9 each, so you got 18. So producing the second unit added $8 to your revenue. You went from 10 to 18, right? When you produce the third unit, you can only sell them for $8 a piece, so you got $24. When you sell three units, you get $24. So the third unit only added 6 to your revenue. You went from 18 to 24, and so on. So the addition to total revenue is less than the sale price of those units. Right, so we're assuming here that, you know, if I produce three units, I sell all three of them for $8 a piece. It's not that I sell the first one for 10, and I sell the second one for 9, and I sell the third one for 8. No, I sell all three of them at $8, and so I earn $24 of revenue if I sell three units. In other words, marginal revenue is declining, and it's declining faster than the price is declining. Okay? And you can calculate if you want to, if you take the time to do it. There are formulas for elasticity of demand. You can show that a linear demand curve has a different elasticity, right, at different parts of the demand curve. What's the point of all this? The point is that if the firm faces a downward sloping demand curve for its product, then it needs to think carefully about not only what quantity it can unload on the market, but what price it can get for each one of those units, right? So if it wants to equate marginal revenue and marginal cost, it's going to do something like this. So this is the example in neoclassical economics of not the perfectly competitive firm, but the firm with market power. What does market power mean? Market power is simply a jargon word for, in neoclassical economics, a firm that faces a downward sloping demand curve for its own product. Okay? So if the firm, here's the demand curve for this firm's product, and here's the marginal revenue curve, right, that lies below the demand curve, and it's steeper than the demand curve. What does the firm do? Well, it chooses to price its product where marginal revenue is equal to marginal cost. So where the marginal revenue curve intersects the marginal cost curve, it's right here. So the profit maximizing quantity for this firm is QM. That's the number of units at which the marginal cost, in other words, the cost of producing one more unit, is exactly equal to the revenue that's received from producing that one more unit. But notice that the firm doesn't have to charge P2 for its product. It can actually charge a higher price, right? Because at the quantity QM, what's the highest price you can charge and still be able to sell that many units? Well, it's up here, PM, right? So the firm looks at the intersection of the marginal revenue and marginal cost curves to find out how much to produce to determine the profit maximizing quantity, but then charges the highest price the market will bear, PM, right? And the monopolist, the firm with market power facing a downward sloping demand curve earns some positive economic profits by charging a markup over marginal cost. Right, the difference between PM and P2 is a markup over marginal cost. So, right, the standard argument is, well, look, what if this market did not just have one seller, one monopoly seller, but what if this was the demand curve for wheat and there were lots and lots and lots of sellers of wheat? Well, if there were lots of sellers competing against each other, well, then the equilibrium would be determined by where the marginal cost curve intersects the demand curve, not the marginal revenue curve, but the demand curve. Right. So if this MC were just a supply curve and D were a demand curve, according to the standard story, the equilibrium price would be P1, and the equilibrium quantity would be Q1. Notice the difference between P1, Q1, and PM, QM, right? This is the standard story, that compared to the quantity that would have obtained on a perfectly competitive market, Q1, the monopolist deliberately restricts output. The monopolist produces less than Q1. It restricts its output to QM so that it can jack the price up over P1 all the way up to PM. And earn a higher profit, right? So compared to the perfectly competitive market, this is a bad deal for consumers, right? Fewer units of the good are produced, so there are fewer units that people can buy and possess and use, and they pay a higher price per unit. They pay the monopoly price, PM, instead of the competitive price, P1. So according to mainstream analysis, this is bad, bad, bad. This is firms ripping off consumers by charging them these dastardly monopoly prices. What's wrong with that? First of all, as Rothbard pointed out, the whole idea of a perfectly elastic horizontal demand curve doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Right? Every firm, no matter how small, faces a downward sloping demand curve. Okay, because every product is in some way different from no seller is identical, right? And there are no infinitesimally small, you know, calculus-based units, right? There are only discrete units that can be bought and sold on a market, right? So it isn't the case that when one wheat farmer adds his quantity of wheat to the market, you know, that doesn't have a zero or infinitesimally small effect on the market. No, the market is made up of discrete bushels of wheat, and you know, five more bushels of wheat is five more bushels of wheat. Right? So as long as the market demand curve is downward sloping, adding even five more bushels of wheat to the market can have an impact on the market price. It may not go down by a lot, but we're not talking about infinitesimally small changes. It goes down by something, okay? This whole idea that firms should be somehow, you know, required to increase their output beyond the profit maximizing quantity, to think the government should step in and force the firm to produce beyond QM. QM is not enough units for us, thank you very much. We want Q1. We want the bigger quantity. And you will produce it, Mr. Firm, Mr. Monopoly Firm, or we will shoot you or send you to jail. As Rothbard pointed out, this violates the property rights of the owners. Right? Remember all of our exchange examples we've been doing with the car radios? Okay. I mean, if we were to say, well, look, let me flip back in the slides for a second. Let me go back to this example here. Yeah, Yeah, let's take this one. Suppose that we said, well, look, you know, Mr. Seller, your reservation price is too high, right? We think that an equilibrium price between 240 and 250 is wrong, right? We think that price is too high. We liked it better in the previous slide when the equilibrium price was between 150 and 200. That's better for consumers. Same equilibrium quantity, 5. So we like this. We like the outcome, what I call monopoly pricing 3. We think that's better than the outcome in monopoly pricing 4, where you have a smaller quantity, Q3, and a higher price. Right? This looks more monopolistic somehow in mainstream terminology than in the previous example. Therefore, the government is going to pass a law that you have to sell all 5 units. Well, I mean, look at it this way. That seems ridiculous. Right? You're compelling the sellers to get rid of their merchandise at a price lower than the price that they, at which they choose to get rid of it. Right? What's wrong with the sellers having a higher reservation price? So in the monopoly example, the sort of mainstream example, slide number 13 here, right? I mean, if you passed a law and said, we require the firm to expand output from QM to Q1 because that will improve market performance somehow. That will lower the price. You know, you, Mr. Seller, you'll still get enough to cover your costs. You'll still get enough to break even. That should be enough for you. Thank you very much. Why should the seller be required to do that? What if the seller says, hey, you know, I want to charge PM. Anything lower than that, you know, I think that I should be able to get a higher price. I can get a higher price later. These additional units beyond QM, I would prefer to keep them in my inventory and save them for possible sale on another date. Or if they're radios, I just want to keep them. I want to listen to them. I want to play with them. I want to touch them. I want to run my fingers through the stack of radios. I mean, why should the seller be outlawed from having those preferences and expressing them in that particular way? Rothbard uses the example of, a movie star. Who's your favorite movie star? You know, Brad Pitt or something like that. You know, Brad Pitt only makes so many movies per year, right? I mean, he's not working 365 days a year. He's taking a lot of vacation time at the beach. Otherwise, how are you going to get those celebrity spy photos that you see in the magazines at the grocery store checkout, right? I mean, Brad Pitt could make more movies than he does. But now, if Brad Pitt made movies all the time and TV shows and commercials and radio spots, if he were constantly working every spare moment of the day, well, then he would become less of a star, right? I mean, then he'd become kind of ordinary and commonplace. And probably he would not be able to negotiate as high a price on the market as he now does. So most celebrities, high-end celebrities, are kind of selective in what projects they take on, what movies they make, or what television shows they're on, because they want to preserve their kind of, you know, rarity. They want to be in demand by restricting how much they make themselves available. Well, I mean, what's wrong with that? Would it be... Could you have the regulator or the antitrust official say, Mr. Brad Pitt, I command you to make another movie this year. It's not up to you to choose how many movies to make. We're going to force you to make more movies. You know, you could make another movie and get paid enough to equal your opportunity cost, to cover your opportunity cost. People would still be willing to see that movie. That would improve social welfare. Therefore, get over to the, you know, movie studio, Mr. Pitt, or we shoot you in the head. Everybody would recognize that as a violation of Brad Pitt's property rights over himself, right? Why should it be any different with Monsanto or Boeing or Microsoft? Another issue too is the mainstream approach holds that, you know, a perfectly elastic demand curve for an individual producer's product is somehow better in a situation where you have a downward sloping demand curve for an individual producer's product. Why? I mean, the elasticity of demand is a choice variable on the part of consumers. Right? I mean, what constitutes a close substitute is subjective, and that's in the minds of the consumers. right? The consumers can choose to regard a McDonald's hamburger as the same as a Burger King hamburger, or they can choose to regard them as different, right? That's up to consumers' subjective preferences. In other words, elasticity of demand is not a technical issue that's given by the physical characteristics of the product. It's subjective and voluntary on the part of consumers. Another point is that the fact that there is only one firm currently in the market does not necessarily mean that firm has market power, right? Because there might be other potential producers, other potential firms who are not in the market at present but might like to be, right? Take the example of so-called predatory pricing, this idea that firms will charge a price low enough so that they can drive all of their competitors out of the market, right? So, Microsoft, or I don't know, take McDonald's. Say, McDonald's has imagine the McDonald's Corporation. It's not a perfect example because it's a franchise, but forget about that. Imagine McDonald's is the most successful. Let's use Starbucks, because Starbucks doesn't franchise. All Starbucks stores actually are company-owned stores, except for some little kiosks. So Starbucks is a profitable company. They got a lot of money. What if Starbucks says, hey, we're going to sell lattes for 5 cents because we know that all the local mom-and-pop coffee shops, they can't afford to sell their coffee at 5 cents. They'll run out of money. But we have a huge cash hoard, so we're going to undercut all of our competitors, even if it means we're making a loss, until we drive all of them out of the market. And then we'll be a monopolist, and then we can charge $8 for a latte, and people will still pay for it because we're the only game in town. That's an example of so-called predatory pricing. Yeah, I mean, Walmart is the classic example. Walmart's critics say Walmart moves into town, and they charge these ultra-low prices just to drive all the local sellers out of business so that Walmart can get a monopoly, and then it will jack prices up and, screw the heck out of the consumers. Of course, it is true that a lot of local retailers cannot effectively compete with Walmart, and they do go bankrupt. They do go out of business. Some local coffee shops can't compete with Starbucks. But, interestingly enough, we have zero evidence of no evidence for any market in which Walmart, once it has driven other firms out of the market, then raises its prices. Walmart keeps selling at low prices even after a lot of the local firms have gone bankrupt. One reason is because if Walmart were to, all of a sudden jack up its prices, if Starbucks all of a sudden were to charge $8 a latte after they've driven out all of the local coffee shops, well, what are entrepreneurs going to do? They're going to jump right back into that market, right? They're going to charge a price lower than Starbucks and keep that price down. So there's pressure on the incumbent from the risk of potential entry, right? Look at this example. Suppose you've got textbook definition, mainstream definition of monopoly. One seller, right? So one seller has a monopoly on car radios and has a reservation price of $290, right? So in this example, if there's one unit to be sold, equilibrium prices, equilibrium quantity is one. Equilibrium price is somewhere between the reservation price of the most capable buyer, B1, and the reservation price of the seller, $290. You go, gosh, that's a really high equilibrium price. This evil seller is, making all this money from these poor buyers. But what if there's another potential seller who's not currently in the market but could get in the market, and that seller's reservation price is $280? Right, if S1 knows that at a price, if the seller tries to charge $290, then the buyer will simply go to S2, right? Or S2 will enter the market and offer the radio to the first buyer at a price of $280. Right? Well, now the equilibrium price is going to be between $300 and $280. Right? Even though S2 is not currently in the market, the prospect of S2 entering the market, the idea that S2 could jump in if S1 charges a price that's above 280, is enough to discipline S1. right? So what affects the outcome in the market is not only the reservation prices of the buyers and sellers currently in the market, but the reservation prices of buyers and sellers who could potentially enter the market. Okay? In other words, the fact that there is currently only one seller in the market does not tell us much about the equilibrium price. We also need to know the behavior of potential sellers. Okay? So there may, you know, Walmart may be the only grocery store in your town, but it does not follow that Walmart doesn't have competition. Right? Because there's competition from the grocers who could enter the market if Walmart were to raise its prices. That's why Walmart keeps its prices low, even if it is the only seller in the market. Okay. What about monopoly granted by the state? What about government granted monopoly? Well, this is a different case, of course, than the ones we've been talking about before. And the government grants monopoly privilege in many ways, right? It's, you know, the obvious ones are, you know, where the government says, by law, only you can be in this market. I mean, a patent is a monopoly, right? It's not a permanent monopoly, but a company that gets a patent on a product now has a deal with the government where if anybody else tries to offer that same product, the patent holder can sue, right? It's unlawful for anybody to compete with the patent holder. You know, exclusive grants and charters and concessions like the Dutch East India Company. Some cities have, you know, a private provider of electricity or the municipal water supply, private operator of a prison that has an exclusive contract with a government agency. That's another kind of monopoly that's given to that private partner. Another kind of more moderate cases like licenses, right? If you have to have a license to be a doctor or a lawyer or to cut hair, right? A lot of cities, you have to get a barber's license before you can cut hair. What that does, that doesn't mean only there can be only one barber in town, but it does restrict the supply of barbers, right? Which allows those barbers who do have a license to charge a higher price. That's why strongest lobbying for occupational licensing rules is always from incumbent businesses, right? What the government says, well, we require all barbers to be licensed for your safety, right? To make sure that somebody who isn't, only people who are really qualified to be barbers can be barbers. I mean, it's a little bit silly when it's hard to justify that if, you know, think about, you know, massage therapists have to be licensed. And, you know, modern barbers, not the old-fashioned barbers who had sharp knives and razor blades and, you know, could cut you and put leeches on you. Okay, you can say, well, maybe that has some medical rationale. But, you know, just a modern hairstylist, what exactly is the government protecting the consumer from? I mean, bad hair? No, these licenses are just to raise the wages of the professionals who are in the licensed profession. That's why they like it. Trade restrictions, tariffs, quotas also give monopoly privilege to those who are protected against competition by the tariff or the quota. Now, there are less obvious kinds of, you know, monopoly privilege granted by the state. Progressive taxation, right? Things that make it difficult for newcomers to accumulate capital provide a kind of protection for incumbents who have already accumulated a large amount of capital. You know, and all kinds of regulations that are ostensibly directed at in other areas, like environmental rules and labor laws, right? These are ways of protecting incumbents against competition as well. There's a whole field of study on this. In the United States, the Clean Air Act of 1970, first major kind of national environmental rule about pollution, it was sold to the public as a means of, you know, protecting the environment and all that stuff. But the act was written with the help of incumbent industrial manufacturing firms, because what the act did was it made it very costly for new firms to enter the market. You know, when you built a new factory, you had to install all this environmentally sensitive equipment to reduce the amount of smoke that comes out of the smokestack and so on. But incumbent firms were grandfathered in. incumbent firms were allowed to continue to operate under, the way they had always done. So, of course, this is a way of protecting incumbents from competition. In the U.S., we have the Americans with Disabilities Act, which requires all firms to provide accommodation for people with disabilities. The extra large bathroom stall with a railing and a large door, a wheelchair ramp, and so on. Again, this was sold to the public as a way of making life better for people with disabilities. But it really didn't have anything to do with that. The Americans with Disabilities Act was designed by large businesses to make it harder for smaller companies to set up shop, right? And then this is something, it's a beggar thy neighbor policy, right? Walmart can set up handicapped parking spaces and install a wheelchair ramp and make sure that everything's accessible much more easily than a mom and pop store, right? A very small shop for which it might be prohibitively costly to install a ramp, to reconfigure the bathrooms, to have other accommodations for the blind or whatever. These kinds of accommodations are more costly per unit for small firms than they are for large firms. So large firms all support them as a way of raising the costs for smaller firms and thus helping the bigger firms. So these are all, there are all kinds of government interventions that either directly or indirectly give particular producers monopoly power, monopoly privilege. I really don't have time to talk about antitrust. In most countries, there are a whole series of laws that neoclassical economists support by saying that, well, if you define monopoly as anything other than perfect competition, then the government should go in and try to somehow force markets to be more like competition. Starbucks should be broken up into smaller firms. Walmart should be outlawed. Certain kinds of mergers should not be allowed to take place because they would give the merged firm too much monopoly power. Sadly, a lot of otherwise good market-oriented economists have supported this view of antitrust, activist antitrust policy, because they have been sucked into the neoclassical notion of competition. If you think competition is a particular market structure that has a lot of firms in it, then you might think, oh, well, competition is a good thing, so we need the government to break up large firms to make sure that markets look like perfect competition. And so we have all kinds of laws in the U.S., and in other countries you have similar laws, which from a causal realist perspective just provide special privilege to particular firms, right? And they're not in any way justified by economic analysis. There's a whole host of practical problems with antitrust too, making its implementation difficult if not impossible. But I wouldn't even bother to talk about those because it's not even sound on theoretical grounds. Some of those theoretical grounds include, of course, the fact that from a causal realist point of view, there is no difference between monopoly prices and competitive prices, except for the case where the government created the monopoly. Right? In the free market, absent government intervention, just like we saw in examples 1 through 4 with my pricing slides, there are just market prices. There are equilibrium prices. There's no such thing as a competitive price or a monopoly price. Right? There are just equilibrium prices. There are all sorts of legal issues, too, that even in neoclassical economics, even in the mainstream approach to antitrust, monopoly prices and competitive prices have to be determined ex post by a judge. There's no way to know when you're setting your price as a firm, whether it's competitive or monopolistic. The whole thing is just completely crazy from legal grounds. Well, it's time to stop. It's an hour and 15 minutes into this session. So before I shut up here and take a few questions, let me just give you some inspirational words about the whole course. I've really enjoyed it. I've had a lot of fun talking about Austrian microeconomics over these 6 sessions. What is it? Well, remember, we're interested in what I call mundane economic topics, prices, quantities, market behavior, competition, monopoly, and so on. Notice we haven't talked about all the esoteric stuff about evolution and spontaneous order and market process and so on. But at the same time, what we have provided is not just a verbal representation of the mathematical neoclassical stuff, but really a whole different way of thinking about market behavior, prices and quantities and so on. Right? It's causal. We emphasize the, you know, we go from the beliefs and preferences of actors to, you know, objective characteristics of reality to outcomes. Okay? It's causal. It's not, there's no mutual simultaneous determination of magnitudes. It's realistic. We're interested in real market behavior. We're not interested in hypothetical, perfectly competitive markets. We're interested in actual markets. Now, like I said at the start of this lecture, we have just barely scratched the surface, right? And the readings from Greaves and from Shapiro, the supplemental readings and so on from Taylor. I mean, I think they're all great, but they're really just pretty introductory. So, you know, there's lots and lots more that you can do. You know, if you haven't tried it yet and you have the time and the courage, I would suggest that you try to work your way through Man, Economy, and State. And after that, try to work your way through Mises, Human Action. I hope that at least some of you will sign up for some of the future Mises Academy courses that we're offering. In particular, those of you who are doing the certificate, starting from Murphy's Principles class, Intro class, this Micro class, and the Austrian Macroeconomics class that will be offered by Joe Salerno starting in just a few weeks. And any of you, I hope you'll consider taking lots of future Mises Academy courses. You know, and I think, and of course in my own research and teaching and policy work, whatever, I think that this causal realist micro is the foundation for all other areas of economics and economic theory and applied economic analysis. You know, the business cycle and entrepreneurship, regulation, trade, education, whatever. Whatever applied topic you're interested in, at its core, at its heart, it's prices and quantities, preferences, marginal payers, and all the rest of it. Okay. Of course, the Mises website, Mises.org, is the world's greatest repository of educational materials, online courses, videos, archived videos and audios, books, articles, discussion forums, the blog, and so forth. The greatest way to learn any kind of economics, particularly causal realist economics. And that is it. That is the end of the lecture and the end of the course. I didn't look much in the chat window as we were going, but let me take a moment to look and see if there's some questions I can answer. Okay, there's some other questions about terminology, how do people define monopoly and so on. In response to Adam Jennison, no, I mean, I'm not familiar with that particular concept, monopoly based on scarcity. Unless you mean monopoly based on exclusive control of a scarce resource, right? So many economists, including Mises, have said, well, one of the conditions, not the only one, but one of the conditions for a monopoly price to emerge, according to Mises, is that you have a seller with exclusive control over a particular scarce resource, diamonds. If one seller possesses every single diamond in the world, then combined with some other things, depending on consumer preferences, depending on the elasticity of demand, the seller might charge a different price than would be the case if there were other potential diamond makers. If that's what you mean by scarcity, then yes, scarcity plays a role in that sense. But, of course, even Mises recognizes that, Mises recognizes that even in a case like that, what constitutes a substitute product is subjective. Right? So even if I possess every single diamond in the world that I offer for sale, what about fake diamonds, two bits of zirconia, What about rubies and sapphires? What about other kinds of jewelry? Or if we're talking about industrial diamonds for cutting, there may be other kinds of materials, both natural and man-made, that can also cut through, whatever, that might be substitutes for diamonds. What does it mean to say you have exclusive control over a resource or a commodity? I mean, what defines the market? What other commodities are substitutes for that one? Depends on people's beliefs. It depends on state of technology. It depends on knowledge and so forth. Okay. Okay. So another question from Adam about distinguishing between goods and services. Adam, I think that whether we're talking about physical goods or services provided, the analysis would pretty much carry all the way through, right? I mean, my Brad Pitt example is about a service, not a good. So if I'm, we could have our same, same diagrams, the same pricing charts that we had, and say, well, okay, instead of radios being sold for $250, these are, units of consulting services. A firm wants to hire a consultant, and some consultants are willing to work for $150 an hour, and some consultants are not willing to work for less than $280 an hour. And the buyers have different valuations of how much the consultant is worth. And I think the analysis would go through in exactly the same way, whether we're talking about physical goods or services. Adam, if I'm misunderstanding your question, or if you have a counterexample in mind, please chime in. Please type that in. Let's see. What else have we got? Hey, lots of great examples. I mean, many of you have heard of silly cases of occupational licensing, cases where the government granted all kinds of monopoly privileges for no conceivable reason other than to favor politically influential donors or whatever. Let's see. Okay, Adam, intellectual capital that is exclusive to one individual. If you mean that everybody's knowledge is unique, then if you wanted to, you could say that every individual has a monopoly over himself. Right? Peter Klein labor is not identical to Bob Murphy labor, thank goodness, or Tom Woods labor, or Joe Salerno labor, or whatever. I can't help picking on Bob because he's such a good guy. In that sense, every worker is a monopolist. Every worker has monopoly power over his own labor. But so what? That's just saying that labor is not homogeneous. I'm not sure what we would do with that claim. It wouldn't affect our analysis of pricing. That wouldn't be a kind of a useful notion of monopoly. If I discover, a new technology, I invent some commodity, then until somebody else invents something that's just like it, then I guess I'm the exclusive seller of that thing. I'm the only one who can sell that thing because I'm the only one who's thought about it. Even forget about patents and stuff, right? Just trade secrets. I invented a new device and nobody else knows how to produce it, and they can't reverse engineer it, then I'm the only seller of that device. But again, here we come into the subjectivity from the consumer side of what's unique. Take anything. So here's, I'm holding up a BlackBerry, I think this is a BlackBerry 9780. Okay, nobody else can produce exactly this. There's probably some Chinese knockoff that's similar, right? But other companies can produce smartphones that share some features, but they're not exactly the same. A lot of BlackBerry aficionados swear that the keyboard on a BlackBerry is better than the keyboard on any other smartphone. Of course, physical keyboards are on the way out, just like BlackBerry itself. Research in Motion is, can imagine, will still be in existence within a year. But let's say I've invented this unique kind of a keyboard. How different is it from the consumer's point of view from the other kinds of keyboards? you know, again, to some people will swear they're totally different. Others won't. I mean, it's like Coke and Pepsi. Some people love Coke and hate Pepsi. Other people love Pepsi and hate Coke and swear that they're completely different. And but there are other people who don't really care and would drink either one. And you know, again, it's up to the subjective preferences and beliefs of the consumers, not the characteristics of the products itself. you know, cold fusion. Okay, if I'm the only one who knows how to do cold fusion, then I guess I have a monopoly on cold fusion. But I don't have a monopoly on energy production, because every nuclear plant that uses fission, every coal-fired electric plant, you know, every wind power electricity generator is also creating energy. So if we define the product as energy, then even the one guy who has the one cold fusion reactor in the world, he doesn't have a monopoly on energy. But you see, of course, the point is, but if we go the other direction, then every single seller has a monopoly if we define the market so narrowly that only their product, that their product is a separate market, okay? do I agree with Kinsella's view on intellectual property? I mean, yes. There's another course that I did, Danny helped me out, that was, I think maybe 1 or 2 years ago, I did a course on kind of networks and technology, a Mises Academy course. There may be a way that we may open up that course, I may teach it again, or we may make the archive materials available for a small charge or whatever. And I devoted a couple of sections exclusively to this whole Kinsella thing, yeah, Networks in the Digital Revolution, it was called. We're actually, by the way, Mises Academy, we're looking at a model of making all of the old Mises Academy courses available after the fact. You know, maybe for a smaller fee. I mean, obviously, people couldn't chat and participate in the lectures live. But so I talked a lot about Kinsella then. But for those of you who don't know, Kinsella's view, well, let me back up. Murray Rothbard thought that patents were not legitimate forms of, were not legitimate economic interventions. But that other kinds of legal protection, more like copyright, Rothbard thought that it was in a pure free market society, you probably would have copyright law to protect authors, musicians, and so on against copying of their work, reproduction of their work. Kinsella argued that no, copyright was also illegitimate, just like patent, that a copyright is a kind of illicit government protection. It's a government-granted monopoly that is not that is neither justified on normative grounds or necessary on efficiency grounds. You know, this is a larger debate here about what the definition of property is. You know, is intellectual property property? Are ideas property? Are thoughts property? Are expressions in a particular word order property? Kinsella argues, in my view, pretty persuasively, that ideas do not meet the requirements for a proper formal legal definition of property. I don't want to say more because we could go on for hours and hours about this, and there are lots of websites and blogs and lectures that you can find. You can find a bunch of Kinsella lectures, I'm sure, on YouTube or on the Mises, on Mises.org, going into this in a lot more detail. Like I say, we can argue about Kinsella and intellectual property on another occasion. But I mean, the relevance for our course here is that you know, whether you think that intellectual property laws, patent law, copyright law, and so on, whether you think they're correct or incorrect, the fact is that if they are used, they do have the effect of granting monopoly privilege. Right? Even defenders of patent law, for example, most mainstream economists think that we should have patent law. And they say, yeah, I mean, we recognize that giving a company a patent gives it a monopoly and lets it charge higher prices than it otherwise would. But, you know, if we have to do that, otherwise people wouldn't have the incentive to invent stuff. right? So, yeah, I mean, we need the benefits of innovation, even though that comes at a cost of higher prices during the duration of the monopoly that the inventor gets. But, you know, that's a trade-off that we're willing to make. That's what most mainstream economists would say. So whatever your view on whether intellectual property is justified or not, intellectual property laws are a form of monopoly, okay? Okay, guys, I think we need to wrap it up. Again, thank you all very much for participating in the course and going on this little adventure with me. I've had a great time. I hope that you have too. By the way, we don't have a final exam for the course. Those of you who are taking the course for a grade will get a grade that is just based on the quizzes. If you have any questions about your quiz scores, problems, issues, whatever, please feel free to contact me or Jacob or Danny, and we will help you the best we can. My email address, pkline@mises.org, you have it, and I would love to talk to you guys, interact with any of you after the course on any subject whatsoever. I hope that I will see you at some future event. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you for reminding me, Adam. We will have a quiz on this week, too. So we'll have a quiz next week the way we have had quizzes on all the previous weeks. And then at the end of next week, when the final scores are compiled, then we'll calculate the grades. And those of you who are getting a certificate will get one, and so on. So we will have another quiz on this material, just like we had before, but no final exam. I lost my train of thought from my inspirational speech. So I really look forward to seeing you guys either virtually or in person, and I encourage you to continue your study of Austrian microeconomics and economics in general. So thanks a lot to Danny and Jacob for great technical and other support during this term, and I look forward to seeing all of you guys soon.